Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hulu's Pam and Tommy, resurrecting a 1990s tabloid story through a millennial lens. We're here today on Crew Call with executive producers Robert Siegel and D.V. DeVincentis, as well as the episodic director and executive producer Craig Gillespie. Okay, how did you know that Lily could play Pam Anderson? How? I mean, she's amazing.
Well, it's a bit of a leap of faith.
Well, I could say from my end, it's like I was kind of unbelievably intrigued by that idea. It's like I'd known all her work in England, and she's kind of known for a lot of period pieces and obviously being British. But it's a real sort of leap to think of her for Pamela. But I love when you get to see an actor do that, when you get to see him play something like the polar opposite of what we know them for.
She totally De Niro'd it.
Yeah. And then it's funny because these guys...
We needed somebody to do that.
Yeah. Robert and DV came over to my house. We had our first rehearsal with Sebastian and Lily. And, we were sort of running some lines, and then... we're like, well, let's go out into the front yard and try that parking lot scene where they come out of the nightclub. And it was the first time we got to see Lily and Sebastian acting together. And I right there was like, wow, the amount of prep she'd done already for the physical transformation, the dialogue, the dialect she had, the mannerisms. It was a massive exhale, I think, to be able to be like, wow, this is going to be amazing. The chemistry.
And also part of the design of the show is that, Pam kind of is not, there's more to Pam than we think, than meets the eye. And so we're sort of subverting expectations that the audience has of Pam. You know, we think of her as this sort of wild, trashy bombshell. But there's in fact a lot more layers to her. And I think to have an actress who also has this kind of, you didn't necessarily expect this of her. I think the two kind of go together really well, as opposed to casting, like Megan Fox or somebody, I think when she was cast, everybody threw out kind of like, well, who's wild? And Pam is a good girl. Like Pam is smart and savvy, and there's just many layers to her. And I just felt like to subvert expectations with the casting really fits with the way Pam subverts expectations kind of in her own life.
What I'm getting to here, because Sebastian is equally amazing. But Sebastian is Tommy in my mind. Is possibly a short walk for him. But with Lily, see, here's the thing. I'm used to hearing the stories. I'm very old fashioned. I'm used to hearing the stories like with, when Milos Forman was looking for his Andy Kaufman, and there's a wide thing and they're reading people and they're videotaping people. And it is and when they settle on the person that's going to play Andy Kaufman, it's all logic. It all makes sense and the universe aligns. And nowadays when I quiz people, like, why did you, oh, this person's amazing the role. Why did you think? They're all kind of like, they just kind of just flippantly decided. And I with her, I'm thinking, was it the eyes? Because she looks like her. I know she studied up on the part. That's out there. But was it the eyes? Was it like, she's got the eyes and we can build around that in addition to the depth?
you mean facially resemblance wise or
facially resemblance wise? No. I mean, it's been a while since I studied Pam Anderson, but for me, she looks exactly like her.
I wasn't worried about how much she looks like her. For me, it came down to Lily as an actor and her performance, and she's so accessible as an actor, and that's what we needed. And it's like at the end of the day, you needed to be able to connect with her and root for her. And in all of her work, she always has that. So the physical transformation, that's all smoke and mirrors. And I felt we would get to a place that is close enough, you know, with like what we have with, you know, in our arsenal now, that it's all that vulnerability that she has and that accessibility and then the intelligence as well, like, you know, in her performance.
So Robert and DV, how did everything come together? The Amanda Chicago Lewis Rolling Stone article was written in 2014. Did you guys get access to it? Did Point Grey have it first? How did this wonderful machine start working?
The article was optioned by Dylan Sellers, our producer, who brought it to Point Grey, Seth Rogen's company. Point Grey brought it to Annapurna, who is our studio. And then Annapurna and Sue Nagel at Annapurna hired me to write the pilot. I wrote the pilot, I wrote the second episode, and then we got greenlit. We shopped it around. Hulu really wanted it bad. We took it to some other places, but we felt like that was the best home for it. And then we staffed up. First hire was who's going to be my my co-showrunner. I'd never done television before. So they got this guy, DVD.
They got this guy.
Okay. Who, you know, had a lot of experience in television, had just come off OJ, where he won an Emmy, and we loved each other. We still do. You know, he wrote the Marsha Clark episode. He wrote Marsha, Marsha, Marsha. And I think there's a lot of, I'll let DV speak to it, but I think there's a lot of, I think our show, I could definitely see the way the two would connect. That was a big part of it, aside from me just liking him as a person.
Yeah, so, I was drawn to it immediately because, and I wasn't really looking to come onto something that was already up and running, but when I read the pilot, it resonated so much with everything that I like to do, which is generally speaking a sort of combination of something fun and frothy on the surface, but that's really about a bunch of stuff underneath, like OJ. This definitely resonated in that way, particularly in the way that Pam was so undersold and the way that Rob clearly was onto that case from the beginning.
So, you know, this in the early 90s, this story was everywhere. What was it about the 2014 Rolling Stone article? Did it bring new light to anything? Or was it just everything?
Yeah, it was, nobody ever knew what happened. And, you know, everybody, including all of us, assumed in the back in the day that they leaked the tape because that's what everybody did after the tapes. And so you kind of retroactively assigned that as the motive or the of what happened. But in fact, that article shows you, you know, a rather step-by-step portrayal of what really happened by Rand Gauthier. And it's the first time he'd ever spoken. I imagine it might have something to do with statutes of limitations. but that was what was so, that's what broke the story wide open, was that article and all of his detail about it.
And the article also really nicely lays out an 8-episode limited series. I mean, it's remarkable how well suited that thing is for a limited. It's just got the three acts and the beginning, middle, end.
And then in reference to Seth Wachowski's involvement as well.
Yes. That was known, but there was certainly more detail about how it went down in that article. But it was, you know, Seth Wachowski was already kind of a boogeyman in this story.
Now, there's something really interesting that the show taps into. Like you said, it, you weren't looking to paint Pam in an ill light, in a salacious light. You were looking to show her humanity because she is a good person. But there's something right in the middle that really, that the series hangs its hook on with her. And it's around the time that she's doing the deposition, and she's basically like, so Tommy isn't called for the deposition, but she is. And it's because she's a woman. And I was wondering if you guys could talk about that, because that's something that's like a very, it's a bias that is brought to light that just takes this from being this, you know, fun kind of 90s ride to, wow, this is something we should really think about.
Are you suggesting there's a double standard?
Absolutely. I mean, that was why I wanted to get involved in this, was because I could see that there was this, you know, I'd always seen her as being sort of undersold. And yeah, it was completely barbaric to see what happened to this person. And frankly, what happens to them after the story, in a way, because she's sort of run out of the, what happens to them is exactly the same. They're in the same video, and yet one gets a second career as a huge personality and is known for his sort of sexual prowess and his penis size and all that. And the other person is like kind of run out of the business, you know? It's, you know, and that is the difference between the way they're treated. It definitely extends into the deposition, and that Tommy wasn't even deposed. And they saw a soft target, and they saw a way to go after somebody.
And it's kind of shocking to see, just to be able to hold a mirror up and see what our culture was like back then and the way that women were treated, and to see the normalcy on talk shows and interviews, and that as a society, everybody was okay with, bizarrely. And it's just to look back on that period and what it was like is really eye-opening to what you were saying, I think, and educational. And it was something too, in terms of how the media handled it and how we as society, you know, again, the commentary on like what's going on now as well with media, that it was something that I thought was interesting. And we did in Itania, and then these guys tapped into it again here, which was that we're complicit. It's like with the consumption of us and what we're doing and without any regard for the individual. So you get to come into this show with these expectations that we already have, these opinions that we've already formed, and then subvert them and hold a mirror up to ourselves that we came in with all these judgments. And with the writing that these guys did, they did this beautiful job of turning by the time you get to that episode of being like, wow, we're really complicit in this. It's like these judgments that they make, the probably the whole purpose of a lot of people who start watching the show in the beginning was because they sort of thought they knew what they were getting. And then to be able to turn that and shine a mirror on ourselves was exciting.
The show is sort of designed to kind of repeat the process of complicity as you're watching it. The first couple of episodes are just that, Craig's episodes are just so incredibly fun. And you get swept up in it and you kind of turn your brain off a little bit, and then it hits you in retrospect. Oh shit, we are a part of the problem.
So I want to know more about Craig coming to the project. He is wonderful when it comes to, you know, shining a light on tabloid tragic heroes. Craig, how did you come to the project? And Deviant Robert, why of course was he the right guy for this?
Well, I can just say right off the top, like the second we heard that he would be interested in doing it, we were just like, great, done. Like, you know, it's just absolutely, like, that was a huge, huge win for us. It was really great, you know, particularly off of Itania. But yeah, so it wasn't like, we just felt very lucky to get him.
And for me, it's like, it's the writing. And I was lucky that this is a very rare situation where these guys had already written all 8 scripts. This was so well fleshed out. And the tone is so clear, and the balance and what they were articulating, that I when I'm reading material, if I'm visualizing it and I can see it already, that's more than half the battle. So as soon as this came in, I'm like, yeah, I want to do it. And it's like everything for me was like, just make sure, you know, I don't this and that, but yeah, just make sure I can do Pam and Tommy to my reps. So it was, I was incredibly excited about it. It's like, I think that just, you know, it's the scripts, I don't think they really changed from the point that I came on. It's like they're already so well dialed in. And, you know, and the first three episodes do go through this very playful thing. But even by the end of the third episode, there's that great speech, you know, and I think it's DV wrote that one with Jane Fonda, where she goes to see her publicist. And you suddenly, it's the first time you're like, wow, there's a lot going on that we're about to be introduced to with this character.
Have any of you heard from Pam or Tommy, you know, after this show has aired? And it, like, have you heard anything like they liked it there, or they were kind of, you know,
nothing from the Pam side. Sebastian has kind of struck up something of a friendship with Tommy. I know they've hung out a couple of times. They met once before the show while we were shooting. They kind of connected.
I think they connected, but they didn't actually meet.
Yeah.
Right? And, they were supposed to, but they didn't. It was really like.
No, I think they met for the first time like last month.
Yeah. So I guess he's okay with it. You know, I don't know if he's seen the show. I don't know.
And Craig, coming back, talk more about the echo here with I, Tanya. Is it basically kind of like the early 90s tabloid machine and just how it reacts, you know, it can react.
I mean, I think the echo there is that it is just this sort of the way that the media takes these lives and consumes them and then and churns through them and moves on. But us as a society, how we like devour that. And without any regard for, you know, the individual, and we form these judgments and these opinions about people and what it is. And then move on. And you it's like, it's to be able to hold, you know, that mirror up and show that these individuals, it impacts them in a very dramatic way. And the you know, that we're going about our lives and not with no regard for that. I think it's a commentary a lot on what's happening all the time now, like with social media, but this was the beginning of it. And, you know, with Tanya Harding, that was the case. And everybody formed their opinions to the point that she became a national joke. And the same with this, it took over. It was the beginning of the internet, and it took over, you know, the dialogue in our society at the time. And it was everywhere. And it was, you know, it was very like shallow in the way that it was approached and callous. And, to be able to look back on that and see how we behaved and how we used to behave and how it's changed or hasn't changed, I thought it was really valuable.
Yeah. Also, I just to add to that, I think that the show, you know, really also shows how much things haven't changed. It's so funny. Like when we were going, Craig mentioned this earlier, when we were going back and looking at appearances of Pam's on talk shows, and not just Pam's, other women from that time. It's like, it's so foul. It's so nasty, the way they're spoken to, the way they're leered at, the way they're sort of like, it's just really gross. And, you know, it's been a very gradual process away from that, but it's still there, you know, like it's just more underground. But yeah.
DB and Robert, how long did it take to write? You were saying the article was like a perfect template for 8 episodes.
We had a four month writer's room.
We're 4 or 5 months.
Yeah. Where we all gathered in a beautiful gazebo on the Annapurna campus. And mapped out the whole thing, you know, the not really done anymore post COVID, but this was sort of our last pre COVID hurrah with the index cards and the dry erase board and sitting around wasting an hour before getting down to work. And then we assigned the episodes. It was myself, DV, Sarah Gubbins, and a writing team, Matt Bass and Teddy Bressman. That was the writing group, and also Brooke Baker.
And we had a writer's assistant, Brooke Baker, became such an integral part of the conversation we were having that we elevated her to write a script as well.
Yeah, she's terrific. And then we assigned episodes and then wrote them. The wonderful thing was that once we wrote them, we were originally going to shoot just a few months after the writer's room ended, and then COVID hit and everything kind of got put on pause. And we had like this 12 month period where we just put the thing down, were able to step away from it, come back to it with fresh eyes, and then have all this time to refine it and fix it and rewrite. So the year after the writer's room, we got this gift. COVID, you know, it's one of the few nice things about COVID was for us, it gave us a chance to rewrite the thing. And looking back, if we had shot it, I mean, it changed so much just because we just simply had more opportunity. It went from being one of those classic TV, come on, hurry up, write it, we gotta shoot it, to like something we could actually do the quote unquote right way, which is like have the time to rewrite it until we felt like we got it right. So that was kind of a blessing in disguise of COVID for us.
What was one of the big seismic changes? Because it ends on a very interesting note, and I like the ending very much, but I was curious if there were other endings that you were toying with.
No, the ending was always what, I don't think the ending changed. I mean, it was a lot of, what I'm talking about is just a ton of fine tuning and, you know, within episodes. Yeah. No, the ending was always, you know, it was kind of a tricky landing to stick. Because, you know, it's one of those, and the three of us are all, I would say myself, DV and Craig are all attracted to stories that end on, in real life, something really depressing and dark happening. And you don't want to.
That ain't no way to end a show.
I like everything, the graduate ending.
Every single thing I write, and I think it's probably true of a lot of their work too, is like, oh, on paper, that's really depressing. How do we find a way to not sell it out, but not leave the audience feeling like they themselves are depressed? So you do that little dark, you know, the little dark twist where there's usually humor is the thing that cuts through the, you know, the bleakness. So for this, yeah, I mean, you had this ended in a, on paper, they were divorced, you know, they broke up. They lost the rights to their tape. It was seen around the world. I mean, no real good came of it. So how do you leave with that bittersweet, you know, half smile?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Also, like the thing we really wanted to show with the end or imply is that you can't break this woman. She's too strong. And she is gonna continue on and not stop. And it's exactly what happened, you know? She's sort of this pervasive, strong person that never stops. I mean, even the, you know, when she goes on these shows, the talk shows, you know, she knows what they're gonna do. She knows that they're gonna, you know, make lewd comments about her, et cetera, but she goes through it anyway because she gets to talk about the things that are really important to her, like animal rights. You watch any of her appearances on a talk show. That's exactly what happens. You watch her nod through it and be a good sport while somebody says dumb shit to her, and then she gets her chance to have a national platform for her, what she cares about. That's the kind of like, that's crazy. That's so strong. And yeah, we wanted to give the impression that she goes off and is going to be okay.
Craig, Robert, DV, thank you so much.
Thank you, man.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Before we go, what are each of you working on?
I'm currently doing a project about Chippendales, the Chippendales murders with Kumail Nanjiani and Murray Bartlett and a bunch of other great people, which is we're shooting right now.
And I'm working on doing a film about GameStop this summer, which was the GameStop stock that happened last year, which is kind of a wild and crazy story.
Is it a movie?
Yeah. Yeah. And it follows our lead, Roaring Kitty, as well as all the Robin Hood guys and the Melvin Capital guys. And it's kind of a big mishmash of all these complicit characters.
And DV?
I'm just trying to build this back porch over here. no, I'm writing, I've just started writing a feature for Netflix that we're kind of trying to get up on its feet and made ASAP about Jimmy and AJ Galante. They're father and son. Jimmy Galante was a sort of mob affiliated garbage titan in Connecticut who loved his high school senior son so much that he bought him a minor league hockey team to manage and own. Called the Trashers. And it's about what happens when somebody is only in love with the harshest parts of hockey and how it kind of brings this town to its feet.
There's an incredible documentary about it.
Yeah. It's a great documentary also on Netflix called Crimes and Penalties. So I'm doing that. I also am doing an animated show at FX that's sort of in the world of the Grateful Dead, but it's about the transportive powers of psychedelics.
Craig, Robert, and DV, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Anthony.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Crew Call podcast on Deadline. I'm your host, Anthony D'Alessandro. Make sure you subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode.